The Eagle's Shadow by James Branch Cabell. 3. And now let us go back a little. In a word, let us utilize the next 20 minutes, during which Miss Hugonin drives to the neighboring railway station in, if you press me, not the most pleasant state of mind conceivable, by explaining a thought more fully to the posture of affairs at Selwood on the May morning that starts our story. And to do this, I must commence with the nature of the man who founded Selwood. It was when the 19th century was still a hearty octogenarian that Frederick R. Woods caused Selwood to be builded. I give you the name by which he was known on the street. A mythology has grown about the name since, and strange legends of its owner are still narrated where brokers congregate. But with the lambs he sheared, and the bulls he dragged to earth, and the bears he gored to financial death, we have nothing to do. Suffice it that he performed these operations with almost uniform success and in an unimpeachably respectable manner. And if, in his time, he added materially to the list of inmates in various asylums and almshouses, it must be acknowledged that he bore his victims no malice, and that on every Sunday morning he confessed himself to be a miserable sinner, in a voice that was perfectly audible 3 pews off. At bottom, I think he considered his relations with heaven on a purely business basis. He kept a species of running account with Providence, and if on occasions he overdrew it somewhat, he saw no incongruity in evening matters with a check for the church fund. So that at his death, it was said of him that he had, in his day, sent more men into bankruptcy and more missionaries into Africa than any other man in the country. In his 65th year, he caught Alfred Van Orden short in lard, erected a memorial window to his wife, and became a country gentleman. He never set foot in Wall Street again. He builded Selwood, a handsome Tudor manor, which stands some 7 miles from the village of Fairhaven, where he dwelt in state, by turns affable and domineering to the neighboring farmers, and evincing a grave interest in the condition of their crops. He no longer turned to the financial reports in the papers, and the pedigree of the Woodses hung in the living hall for all men to see, beginning gloriously with Woden, the Scandinavian god, and attaining a respectable culmination in the names of Frederick R. Woods and of William, his brother. It is not to be supposed that he omitted to supply himself with a coat of arms. Frederick R. Woods evinced an almost childlike pride in his heraldic blazonings. The Woods arms, he would inform you with a relishing gusto, are vert, an eagle displayed, barry argent and jewels, and the crest is out of a ducal coronet, or a demi-eagle proper. We have no motto, sir. None of your ancient coats have mottos. The Woods eagle he gloried in. The bird was perched in every available nook at Selwood. It was carved in the woodwork, was set in the mosaics, was chased in the tableware, was woven in the napery, was glazed in the very china. Turn where you would, an eagle or two confronted you. And Hunsdon Wick, who was accounted something of a wit, swore that Frederick R. Woods at Selwood reminded him of a sore-headed bear who had taken up permanent quarters in an aviary. There was one, however, who found the bear no very untractable monster. This was the son of his brother, dead now, who dwelt at Selwood as heir presumptive. Frederick R. Woods' wife had died long ago, leaving him childless. His brother's boy was an orphan, and so, for a time, he and the grim old man lived together peaceably enough. Indeed, Billy Woods was in those days as fine a lad as you would wish to see, with the eyes of an inquisitive cherub and a big toe head, which Frederick R. Woods fell into the habit of cuffing heartily, in order to conceal the fact that he would have burned Selwood to the ground, rather than allow anyone else to injure a hair of it. In the consummation of time, Billy, having attained the ripe age of 18, announced to his uncle that he intended to become a famous painter. Frederick R. Woods exhorted him not to be a fool and packed him off to college. Billy Woods returned on his first vacation with a fragmentary mustache and any quantity of paint tubes, canvases, palettes, maul sticks, and such like paraphernalia. Frederick R. Woods passed over the mustache and had the painter's trappings burned by the second footman. Billy promptly purchased another lot. His uncle came upon them one morning, rubbed his chin meditatively for a moment, and laughed for the first time so far as known in his lifetime. Then he tiptoed to his own apartments, lest Billy, the lazy young rascal was still abed in the next room, should awaken and discover his knowledge of this act of flat rebellion. I dare say the old gentleman was so completely accustomed to having his own way that this unlooked-for opposition tickled him by its novelty. Or perhaps he recognized in Billy an obstinacy akin to his own. Or perhaps it was merely that he loved the boy. In any event, he never again alluded to the subject, and it is a fact that when Billy sent for carpenters to convert an upper room into an atelier, Frederick R. Woods spent 2 long and dreary weeks in Boston in order to remain in ignorance. Billy scrambled through college, somehow, in the allotted 4 years. At the end of that time, he returned to find new inmates installed at Selwood. For the wife of Frederick R. Woods had been, before her marriage, one of the beautiful Anstruther sisters, who, as certain New Yorkers still remember, those grizzled, portly, rosy-gilled fellows who prattle on provocation of Jenny Lind and Castle Garden and remember everything, created a pronounced furor at their debut in the days of Crinoline and the Grecian Bend. And Margaret Anstruther, as they will tell you, was married to Thomas Hugonin, then a gallant cavalry officer in the service of Her Majesty, the Empress of India. And she must have been the nicer of the two, because everybody who knew her says that Margaret Hugonin is exactly like her. So it came about naturally enough that Billy Woods, now an Artium Baccalaureus, if you please, and not a little proud of it, found the colonel and his daughter then on a visit to this country, installed at Selwood as guests and quasi-relatives. And Billy was 22, and Margaret was 19. Precisely what happened, I'm unable to tell you. Billy Woods claims it is none of my business, and Margaret says that it was a long, long time ago and she really can't remember, but I fancy we can all form a very fair notion of what is most likely to occur when two sensible, normal, healthy young people are thrown together in this intimate fashion at a country house where the remaining company consists of 2 elderly gentlemen. Billy was forced to be polite to his uncle's guest, and Margaret couldn't well be discourteous to her host's nephew, could she? Of course not. So it befell in the course of time that Frederick R. Woods and the colonel, who had quickly become a great favorite by virtue of his implicit faith in the Eagle, and in Woden, and Sir Percival de Vaux of Hastings, and such like flights of heraldic fancy, and had augmented his popularity by his really brilliant suggestion of Wynkyn de Worde, the famous 16th century printer, as a probable collateral relation of the family, it came to pass, as I say, that the two gentlemen nodded over their port and chuckled and winked at one another and agreed that the thing would do. This was all very well, but they failed to make allowances for the inevitable quarrel and the subsequent spectacle of the gentleman contemplating suicide and the lady looking wistfully toward a nunnery. In this case, it arose, I believe, over Teddy Anstruther, who, for a cousin, was undeniably very attentive to Margaret, and in the natural course of events, they would have made it up before the week was out, had not Frederick R. Wood selected this very moment to interfere in the matter. Ah, si vieillesse savait. The blundering old man summoned Billy into his study and ordered him to marry Margaret Hugonin, precisely as the colonel might have ordered a private to go on sentry duty. 10 days earlier, Billy would have jumped at the chance. 10 days later, he would probably have suggested it himself. But at that exact moment, he would have as willingly contemplated matrimony with Alecto, or Medusa, or any of the Furies. Accordingly, he declined. Frederick R. Woods flew into a pyrotechnical display of temper and gave him his choice between obeying his commands and leaving his house forever. The choice, in fact, which he had been according Billy at very brief intervals ever since the boy had had the measles 15 years before and had refused to take the proper medicines. It was merely his usual manner of expressing a request or a suggestion, but this time, to his utter horror and amaze, the boy took him at his word and left Selwood within the hour. Billy's life, you see, was irrevocably blighted. It mattered very little what became of him. Personally, he didn't care in the least, but as for that fair, false, fickle woman, perish the thought. Sooner 1,000 deaths. No, he would go to Paris and become a painter of worldwide reputation. The money his father had left him would easily suffice for his simple wants. And some day, the observed of all observers in some bright hall of gaiety, he would pass her coldly by, with a cynical smile upon his lips, and she would grow pale and totter and fall into the arms of the bloated Silenus, for whose title she had bartered her purely superficial charms. Yes, upon mature deliberation, that was precisely what Billy decided to do. Followed dark days at Selwood. Frederick R. Woods told Margaret of what had occurred, and he added the information that, as his wife's nearest relative, he intended to make her his heir. Then Margaret did what I would scarcely have expected of Margaret. She turned upon him like a virago and informed Frederick R. Woods precisely what she thought of him. She acquainted him with the fact that he was a sordid, low-minded, grasping beast, and a miser, and a tyrant, and I think a parricide. She notified him that he was thoroughly unworthy to wipe the dust of his nephew's shoes, an office toward which, to do him justice, he had never shown any marked aspirations, and that Billy had acted throughout in a most noble and sensible manner, and that personally, she wouldn't marry Billy Woods if he were the last man on earth, for she had always despised him. And she added the information that she expected to die shortly, and she hoped that they would be both sorry then. And subsequently, she clapped the climax by throwing her arms about his neck and bursting into tears and telling him he was the dearest old man in the world and that she was thoroughly ashamed of herself. So they kissed and made it up. And after a little, the Colonel and Margaret went away from Selwood, and Frederick R. Woods was left alone to nourish his anger and indignation, if he could, and to hunger for his boy, whether he would or not. He was too proud to seek him out. Indeed, he never thought of that. And so he waited, alone in his fine house, sick at heart, impotent, hoping against hope that the boy would come back. The boy never came. No, the boy never came because he was what the old man had made him, headstrong and willful and obstinate. Billy had been thoroughly spoiled. The old man had nurtured his pride and applauded it as a mark of proper spirit. And now it was this same pride that had robbed him of the one thing he loved in all the world. So at last the weak point in the armor of this sturdy old Pharisee was found, and fate had pierced it gaily. It was retribution, if you will, and I think that none of his victims in the street, none of the countless widows and orphans that he had made, suffered more bitterly than he in those last days. It was almost 2 years after Billy's departure from Selwood that his body servant, coming to rouse Frederick R. Woods one June morning, found him dead in his rooms. He had been ailing for some time. It was his heart, the doctors said, and I think that it was, though not precisely in the sense which they meant. The man found him seated before his great carved desk, on which his head and shoulders had fallen forward. They rested on a sheet of legal cap paper, half covered with a calculation in his crabbed old hand as to the value of certain properties, the calculation which he never finished. And underneath was a mass of miscellaneous papers, among them his will, dated the day after Billy left Selwood, in which Frederick R. Woods bequeathed his millions unconditionally to Margaret Hugonin when she should come of age. Her 21st birthday had fallen in the preceding month, so Margaret was one of the richest women in America, and you may depend upon it that if many men had loved her before, they worshipped her now, or at least said they did, and after all, their protestations were the only means she had of judging. She might have been a countess, and it must be owned that the old colonel, who had an honest Anglo-Saxon reverence for a title, saw this chance lost wistfully. And she might have married any number of grammarless gentlemen, personally unknown to her, whose fervent proposals almost every male brought in. And besides these, there were many others, more orthodox in their wooing, some of whom were genuinely in love with Margaret Hugonin, and some, I grieve to admit, who were genuinely in love with her money. And she would have none of them. She refused them all with the utmost civility, as I happen to know. How I learned it is no affair of yours. For Miss Hugonin had remarkably keen eyes, which she used to advantage. In the world about her, they discovered very little that she could admire. She was none the happier for her wealth. The piled-up millions overshadowed her personality, and it was not long before she knew that most people regarded her simply as the heiress of the Woods fortune, an unavoidable encumbrance attached to the property, which diverse thrifty-minded gentlemen were willing to put up with. At the thought, her pride rose in a hot blush, and it must be confessed she sought consolation in the looking-glass. She was an humble-minded young woman, as the sex goes, and she saw no great reason there why a man should go mad over Margaret Hugonin. This decision, I grant you, was preposterous, for there were any number of reasons. Her final conclusion, however, was for the future to regard all men as fortune hunters and to do her hair differently. She carried out both resolutions. When a gentleman grew pressing in his attentions, she more than suspected his motives, and when she eventually declined him, it was done with perfect courtesy. But the glow of her eyes was at such times accentuated to a marked degree. Meanwhile, the eagle brooded undisturbed at Selwood. Miss Hugonin would allow nothing to be altered. "The place doesn't belong to me, attractive," she would tell her father. "I belong to the place. Yes, I do. I'm exactly like a little cow thrown in with a little farm when they sell it, and all my little suitors think so, and they are very willing to take me on those terms, too. But they shan't, attractive. I hate every single solitary man in the whole wide world but you, beautiful. And I particularly hate that horrid old eagle. But we'll keep him, because he's a constant reminder to me that Solomon, or Moses, or whoever it was that said all men were liars, was a person of very great intelligence. So that I think we may fairly say the money did her no good. If it benefited no one else, it was not Margaret's fault. She had a high sense of her responsibilities, and therefore, at various times, endeavored to further the spread of philanthropy and literature and theosophy and art and temperance and education and other laudable causes. Mr. Canaston, in his laughing manner, was wont to jest at her varied enterprises and term her Lady Bountiful. But then, Mr. Canaston had no real conception of the proper uses of money. In fact, he never thought of money. He admitted this to Margaret with a whimsical sigh. Margaret grew very fond of Mr. Canaston because he was not mercenary. Mr. Canaston was much at Selwood. Many people came there now, masculine women and muscleless men for the most part. They had, every one of them, some scheme for bettering the universe, and if among them Margaret seemed somewhat out of place, a butterfly among earnest-minded ants, her heart was in every plan they advocated, and they found her purse-strings infinitely elastic. The girl was pitiably anxious to be of some use in the world, so at Selwood they gossiped of great causes, and furthered the millennium, and above them, the eagle brooded in silence. And Billy? All this time, Billy was junketing abroad, where every year he painted masterpieces for the Salon, which, on account of a nefarious conspiracy among certain artists, jealous of his superior merits, were invariably refused. Now Billy is back again in America, and the Colonel has insisted that he come to Selwood, and Margaret is waiting for him in the dogcart. The glow of her eyes is very, very bright. Her father's careless words this morning, coupled with certain speeches of Mr. Canaston's last night, had given her food for reflection. "He wouldn't dare," says Margaret to no one in particular. "Oh, no, he wouldn't dare after what happened 4 years ago." And Margaret-like, she has quite forgotten that what happened 4 years ago was all caused by her having flirted outrageously with Teddy Anstruther in order to see what Billy would do.